folks. Thanks for tuning in to the BAMF podcast, formerly the Vigilance Press podcast. I am your ever-eager and ready host, Mike Laffrey. And with me today is Ben Robbins. How you doing, Ben?
Hello, I'm doing well. That was my podcast voice. I like that.
That was that was nice, man. I really like that. I felt a tingle on my spine.
It's when in case I have to go into a radio announcing, I'll use that voice.
Very, very nice. Don't quit your day job, kid. Ben Robbins might need an introduction for some of you. Ben Robbins was involved earlier in Mutants and Mastermind third-party stuff in the Superlink license under Lame Mage Productions. Had a series of short adventures, or short scenarios, I guess we should call them. And what was the brand name on those, Ben?
Well, there, a lot of them were the Dr. Nell adventures, and then there were also the Evil Genius series, which only got to two series before I kind of stopped publishing in Superlink. So. Mm-hmm.
And these are also available for purchase at Your Games Now or RPG Now?
Yeah, though I guess they're pretty dated now. They're all second edition, and I'd like to think that the technology has advanced since then. That there's new and even better adventures that have been released since those days.
Oh, I'm sure there has been. I've seen some second ed stuff sell pretty well. Charlie McElvey at Zion Games put out his Watch Guard source book, and it was really really nice. Had comic book artists drawing his stuff. And it looked to me, and I haven't talked to Charlie about the numbers, but his second ed version, I think, sold better than his third ed version.
Fascinating. Yeah, I wasn't aware of what kind of market segmentation, like splitting up people who stayed behind and kept using second edition versus.
Yeah. Well, now his second ed was out first by a couple months. That might have been part of it, too.
It
was an awesome looking book, and the art was really amazing. And you might not have wanted to wait for third ed. But anyway, I'm just saying there might still be a market for second ed out there in terms of go buy Ben's stuff. He's really cool, is all I'm saying.
I guess it surprises me sometimes because I think of it. People mention it, and I go, "Oh, those are really dated." And then I go back periodically, and I'll read them. I'll go back and read, like, Death of Dr. Null, and I'll read through it, and I'll be like, "This is really fun." I kind of forget how much fun the adventures were, because as your own worst critic, you look at your own stuff and go, "Like, ah, that wasn't that good," and then you look back at it and go, "It's actually pretty exciting."
Yeah, Battle on Bay Bridge, which is available for free in RPG Now. That was the first Mutant Smash Mind adventure I ever ran. I ran that for three or four different groups, and that was the start of one long-running campaign I had for about a year.
That was actually originally the second Mutant Smash Mind game I ran. The scenario that was based on was an actual game we played. It was like our second game ever.
Now, you were in beta testing for Second Ed, weren't you?
Yeah. Sworn to Secrecy. We signed up. There was a call for playtesters, but we didn't quite know what it was for. And we signed up to do playtesting, thinking it would be for other products. And I think the first – we did another product that was actually still a first-ed product. And then the big reveal was that we were working on second edition Mutants and Masterminds, which is – I think I'm still sworn to secrecy on some points. I might have to be evasive about some but there was a lot of playtesting. That was many, many months of playtesting and lots of playtesting, lots of work went into that. And seeing the different iterations of it was very fascinating and sometimes heartbreaking because you get a version and you start to play it and go, "Oh, this is fantastic." And then, like, 2 weeks later, there'd be a whole different version and a lot of the rules would have changed again to be completely different. And it would just be kind of like, "Boy, I love that. Where's my hellfire power? I like that so much." And like, nope, it's gone. Got to do something else.
Can you talk about any of the things that disappeared, or is that still covered under an ironclad?
It's that kind of thing that it's any game system. You can't really separate individual parts. It's all how it all works together. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to even – I mean, there exists so many different levers being moved up and down to adjust it differently. But I think the end product was really, really good. I'm very happy. I like the end product a lot. So.
Oh, yeah. 2E was amazing. And 3 – I'm not knocking 3. 3 is great, and I've played it several times on this very podcast. So, yeah. Definitely. But you kind of moved on from Mutants and Mastermind. I remember we were trading emails at one point, and you were like, me and my group have been playing Mutants and Mastermind for so many years now. We just need to do something else. And at that point, you kind of got into story games, right?
Yeah, I got into story games specifically, and then really broadly what was going on was that I was shifting away from GMing, that I'd been GMing really for three decades, a long time, a very, very long time. I'd been the GM.
And hey, hate to interrupt, but I want to throw this out, and I will forget it later. You wrote an article about D&D Summer Camp that actually got a lot of attention on the internet. Boing Boing had I think maybe Slashdot might have run it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that before we go on to the story game stuff?
Well, it kind of fits. It's kind of part and parcel of that, but that's the olden days. Like, I was Shippensburg Adventure Game Camp, and as an interview, I'd mentioned it. There's some sort of people were talking about old school stuff, and I had mentioned, I was like, well, you think that's good? I went to the D&D camp, and I threw up the picture of the D&D camp, and one of the people on the thread said, like, basically said, wow, you've got to tell me more. And then he basically wanted to interview me for it, which is where the article you're talking about comes from. But the
sorry, I have a dog in the background. D&D pisses her off something fierce. She misses Thacko. She's an old school dog. So you were talking.
But yeah, so Shippensburg Adventure Game Camp was I'm not sure if it's the only one of its kind or just list. I have no idea. But it was it was in the summer at Shippensburg College in Pennsylvania, and it was,
what was the year?
What was that? 81, 80? I can't remember precisely. It was early on. It would have been, I think 81 might have been the first one. And all this is documented. Like in that interview, we broke down all the years and all the who was where and what. So we got all the facts down. But basically there was 5 years in a row, and I went from being a camper initially to, in the fourth year, I was a counselor in training, and then the fifth year I was a counselor proper, and then the camp got shut down after that, unfortunately. But it was sanctioned by TSR enough so that, like, Frank Mentzer came a couple of years to talk about the latest modules and to talk about the RPGA and talk about, you know, good DMing skills, all that kind of stuff.
Nice. What was the most important thing you learned as far as good DMing skills go?
That's hard to say. It's weird. I mean, you're a kid, right? And you're sitting in lectures learning about DMing. I think probably the best lesson I learned about DMing that was directly from one of the guys who was one of the guys who ran it, Larry Witzler Weitzel. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. But Larry was great. He was a fantastic guy. He was kind of the brains behind running the gaming camp in the later years. And he, on the side, was GMing a game of his own system for the counselors. And as a GM, watching the way he GMed in this very, I guess, inscrutable would be the way to put it. He just kind of had this very neutral, like he was representing the world, but he wasn't jumping up and down. He wasn't being a storyteller. He was being very kind of a calm referee in letting us do things. And that was actually, I think, a really good example for a long time of a really good way to GM, as opposed to GMing in this kind of like, I'll be dramatic and you'll all be quiet, which I think is what a lot of GMing is, what a lot of people think GMing is now.
Yeah, I would agree.
And if you ever followed like the West Marches articles, it was the D&D game I ran before Meet some Masterminds.
And they could find that on your lamemage.com blog?
Yeah, there's links to all that stuff from there. But that's that was the same kind of thing, the idea of having the GM be kind of a silent reflection of the world or the engine that describes the world instead of being kind of like a storyteller who takes the place of the players. So.
And this kind of goes hand in hand, I think, with the philosophy you had in Mutants Mastermind Adventure, which was don't present plots, prevent scenarios. It's almost like every little adventure was a very small sandbox.
Yeah, I mean, when I did the adventures I released, I definitely played that way or did them that way. I think when I was GMing Mutants and Masterminds, I wasn't really doing that because it was a very traditional, like, we've got a big story, we've got a huge campaign arc. I think I was being more of a traditional storytelling GM in that game. But then when I went and wrote them as modules, I kind of had to take a step back and say, well, how would someone else run this? Because, I mean, the trick, you've written these adventures yourself and released them, that there's always that dilemma that you don't know the players. You're not the GM. You're writing a module for someone else who's going to GM people who they know. So you can't say what they're going to like or dislike, so you have to kind of – or what they're going to do or what, you know, what the actions will take. So you have to kind of take a step back and admit that you don't know any of that stuff and say, well, how can I give someone good advice not knowing who they're going to be GMing, you know, or what even characters they're going to have? So you do have to be a little more open-minded about what may happen at the table, and you can't presume to know what will happen.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Actually, I've been struggling with some adventures I'm writing here lately for Icons. And I've been trying to write, I guess, overwrite, really, and try to put through every contingency.
Yeah.
The problem is you're writing yourself into a corner there because you don't know who's going to be at their table.
No.
And,
Or even what kind of games they like, whether they're tactical players or do they like, you know, are they all role-playing? Are they going to, you know, what is their level of enjoyment? You just don't know, and there's no way you can physically know.
Yeah, so you kind of – I guess I'm kind of following your model from those adventures you wrote back in the day. It was sort of more scenarios, more broad sketches, more, you know, here's some mechanical stuff that can help you if you go this way or that way. But, I mean, it's in a way, it's more of a sandbox because, you know, it's if I presume too much, I'm really writing a worse product.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where things like the bullet-pointed revelations were really helpful because things like you know, well, these are the key points to touch base on. How you get to them is going to be unknown, but at least you kind of know, like, these are key elements that would make the story make sense. But yeah, it's you just don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So your evolution as a game master slash game writer has progressed through Mutants and Masterminds and the product sheet for that onto where you are today, which is what we're talking about, which is the Microscope RPG, which has been getting rave reviews.
Well, and there's a big transition in there that I think it kind of leads us to Microscope, is that when I stopped doing Mutants and Masterminds, I did a couple of other indie games and I was still GMing, but I realized that pretty much I had GM'd a very, very long time, and that I was curious that coming with GMing comes a certain, like, you have a social control over the situation, you're in charge of fictionally what's happening, you're in a very unique position at the table, and over time I was kind of interested in trying to do things differently and kind of trying to shake that up. And there's a lot of GM-less games around. It's still kind of a young field. And so I started moving towards playing games like that, games where when you sit down at the table, there is nothing prepared. No one has anything in their hands. No one has a preset idea for an adventure. No one's in charge. But the rules of the game give you a way to collaboratively make the story and collaboratively make the adventure and collaboratively provide each other with challenges. And at first it seems crazy. Like, if you told me that, you know, 10 years ago back when I was playing D&D, I would have said, that's impossible. That can't possibly work. You know, you need a GM. And it is a challenge, but there are ways to do it. And that's what kind of – playing games like that is kind of what led me to thinking that's kind of the only kinds of games I have played in the last couple of years have been GM-less games, pure games. What's that?
Give some examples.
Shock is a great one. It's a science fiction game. Fiasco is very well known now. Fiasco was a major breakout hit.
Fiasco is awesome, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Fiasco is a good one. Polaris is a mutual gameplay. There's a lot of them. Those three are really solid ones. There's other ones that are a variety. Like Geiger Counter has actually never been released officially finished, but it's a very good game. Lots of games like that. But all of those games are games where you start off with nothing kind of in hand. You kind of come to the table and go, it's like Shock, you have nothing. And you say, like, well, we need to sit down and first we make a game world very loosely, and then we play out a story in it. So that kind of stuff is very fascinating, that you could have the fun of being a GM, of making a game world, but for everybody as part of the play, you do that. Though in the other games, I mean, they do that to some degree. Shock probably is closest, but then when I was doing Microscope, that was kind of one of my real motivations, was that the entire time that I've been a GM, I mean, you know, anybody who's out there as a GM will admit that one of the most biggest funs they have is making their world. That running a game is great, but sitting down and just, you know, plotting out your world and building religions and, you know, building continents and writing a player history, that people do that for years without ever running a game. They enjoy it so much. And they can even – go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I've talked to a lot of guys about for a lot of guys in our age group, old school World of Darkness was kind of a touchstone because, you know, a lot of us were like, hey, this is easier than D&D and we can have fun. Hey, girls are playing. And big thing about the old World of Darkness was you had sometimes spend hours just talking about the meta plot with your friends, and that meta plot would never make even a cameo into your table.
Right.
You know, everything that was going on between various clans and tribes and traditions, it was great in the books, but the chance of you running a chronicle that actually touched on that was, you know, very small. It was almost like, you know, that was the fiction, that was the wallpaper behind what you were doing. So,
And that's a very powerful thing. And that if you have that, if there's a player, you have that kind of involvement in the background, in the history, you feel much more connected to the world than just being like, oh, I'm in a passive story where I just follow whatever the latest breadcrumb is the GM has thrown out at me. And like, so when people play Microscope, they sit down, they play it, and then they immediately say, you know, like 9 times out of 10, someone says, wow, that's fantastic, this world we just built together. Now I want to really play like a normal campaign in it. I want to play D&D or something in it. Which is fantastic, because then instead of being a world that someone kind of is giving to them and kind of trying to convince them is cool, they feel like they own it already and they made it, so they have an intimate knowledge of the world itself in there, and they're excited about it. They're thrilled to explore it.
Yeah, it almost sounds like, you know, just I've been playing around with script writing a little bit the last couple of years. It almost sounds like it would be a great thing to have in a writer's room.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that. A lot of people have said a great quote from the owner of Gamma Ray Games was that you could literally fire half the writers in Hollywood and just throw this book at the other half, and then we would have television shows and TV series and movies for the next decade, you know.
And maybe Malcolm Gladwell wouldn't have sucked so much the last couple episodes.
That's exactly right. Yes, that is. I have to agree with you there. Yes, but that could have saved Battlestar Galactica.
No more magical space angels.
Yes, no more magical space angels. Or right, if somebody threw in magical space angels, you would have just gone back in time and said, hey, you know what, that's nice, but we're going to go back to season one and play more in season one because I don't like what you did to season five or four. Four and a half, yeah.
Very nice. Okay, take me through a session. I mean, I know that Microscope's a very involved game and every session is going to take a few hours, but can you kind of give us, you know, the broad strokes of what happens when you sit down and play Microscope?
Yeah, So the key is that the key dynamic of Microscope is that you're going from simple to complicated. You're starting off knowing very little or having a very simplified idea of something, and then you're drilling down and finding out more about it. And that's true from the very beginning of the game, and it's true. It's going to be true at every point of the game. You're going to know in very broad strokes what happened, and then you're going to get into more detail. So, like the very beginning of the game, you say, we're going to make this vast epic history, and you need basically one sentence to sum it all up. So if you think of, like, if you were a kid in middle school and someone tells you for the first time about the Roman Empire, they say, hey, guess what? There was this thing called the Roman Empire, and it arose and it conquered, you know, a lot of Europe and unified all this land, and then it was destroyed by barbarians. That's the Roman Empire. That's it. That's the whole summary of the Roman Empire. As a kid, you're done. That's it. That's the Roman Empire. That's all you need to know. And in a Microscope game, you start off with just that level of information, some very simple summary, like mankind, you know, leaves Earth and expands to form a stellar empire. Boom, that's the whole story. Effectively, at that point, you could literally get up from the table and walk away and say, hey, we made a Microscope history. That's what it was. Mankind left Earth and went to the stars. And that would be the entire summary of what happened. But instead, you say, let's not stop there. Let's keep going, and let's explore that further. And so then the next thing you do is you set up the bookmarks. You set up the beginning and end of your history. Like, well, where are we going to start our history arbitrarily? You say, like, well, let's start when, you know, the first spaceships leave Earth. And go, okay, let's choose to do that. And say, where's it going to end? How is this all going to end? How's our story going to end? And this is a very critical decision. And you might say, let's have the galaxy unified by a peaceful stellar empire. You might do that. You might say, let's have humanity die out and become lost in the stars and lose touch with its home world. But the key point is that now you're saying, if you take that same initial summary and say, this is how the history began, this is how the history ended again, now you know a little bit more about your story. But there's a big missing bit of what happened in the middle. How did we get to this end point? It's like literally we know the end of the story now. We know it's going to happen irrevocably. We can't change it. But we don't know why. We don't know why it turned out that way. And so as you keep playing, you're fleshing out that middle bit. You're basically adding – each player is adding more details to show us how we got from point A to point B. And one of the fascinating things is because you know how things are going to end usually, like if there's a war, you generally know the end of the war before you know all the details. Because you don't have to worry about figuring out what does happen at the end, you're freed up to focus on the meaning of it, the why did this happen. You know what I mean? Like, for example, if you're playing D&D, you're in a fight, fighting a big dragon. The question is, are you going to win or not? Are you going to kill the dragon? Think about it, right? That's what you do not know yet, who is going to win this fight. Imagine we started the fight and I said, this is the fight in which your hero slays the dragon. That's going to happen. Now that element is no longer the question. We're not worried about whether you're going to win. We know you're going to win. Now the question might be, you know, how far are you going to go to win, or what are you going to sacrifice to win? That becomes the question. We get into this much more meaningful question because the actual arc of the action has already been decided.
So you get to, you know, put more themes in there instead of trying to, you know, graft them on to, you know, actual play. I'm guessing you don't actually roll dice in a Microscope.
No dice. Yeah, dice. In fact, there is the funny part is people say, like, oh, my God, no dice. But there's a better randomizer. There is a much better randomizer that we use.
What's that? Let's go.
Human beings.
Okay. How's that?
It's like the Matrix. We use human beings. No, if you think about it, right, if we sit down at a table, say four of us sit down at a table, and we are all coming up with ideas, and we talk openly, and we say, hey, what about this idea? You know, let's have our empire have a planet that they've removed from a sun and is flying through interstellar space by itself, you know, and that's going to be our world. Great. And we talk and we kick around ideas. We'll come up with a reasonably good idea, but we'll have agreed to whatever we come up with. We'll have this like vetting process and collaboration. And we won't be surprised because we'll have had this discussion. What Microscope does is Microscope says, when it's your turn to make something and to add something to the history, you have soul power. No one else gets to veto you. And more importantly, or also no one gets to coach. You're not allowed to ask for ideas. It's your go. You know what I mean? If it's Mike's turn, Mike has to come up with something. Okay. And the fascinating part about that is that you will therefore be, because you can't even choose to try to synchronize your ideas, you'll be very surprised with what other people come up with.
So it's kind of like an informal, like in Fiesta, you have a tilt, which is sort of a mechanical, hey, we're going to screw with you now thing, but this is more just organic.
It's almost as though, I mean, the tilt is a mechanical, you roll dice in the middle of the session, you pick from a chart. This is almost like every single thing that someone comes out of, I mean, think about like a conversation. You never know what someone's going to say next, right? This is like having a conversation on a global scale. When someone else says like, oh, I'm going to start it, you know, the next thing that happens or the thing I'm going to add to the game is, you know, a new religious cult. And then someone else, and that's the other thing, is you're building on each other's ideas because of the way the hierarchy of concepts work, from periods, which are very large, to events, which are smaller, to scenes, which are the smallest still. You're always building inside of someone else's concept. So if one person makes a religion, a crusade that sweeps across the stars, the next person says, well, I'm going to make an event inside of that, and my event is going to be the time when the people who found the crusade, who start the crusade, end on an alien world and find strange alien artifacts. They've now suddenly changed the idea that the first person had. They've built on it unexpectedly. You know what I mean? The first person might say like, "Oh no, I didn't see that. You know, I don't want that to be that." But guess what? They don't have a choice. They're I don't want to say stuck because that sounds wrong, but they are forced to roll with the creativity of other players. And so we constantly surprise each other as we go.
One of the basic rules in any kind of improv is accept and go along.
Exactly.
Because the worst kind of improv is you have a guy on stage saying, oh, no, wait, that didn't happen. Let's do it this way instead. And the audience is like, what the hell? Damn.
Right. But a lot of people listening to this are probably saying, like, wow, I don't want to play that game now. That doesn't sound like fun. And they would be right. If it was a linear game, like we're playing D&D and we're going on an adventure, if each person could just kind of take the story wherever they wanted, it would be really frustrating because you'd be like, oh, we're in a town and I'm thinking later on, I want to go talk to the king. And someone's like, well, on my turn, we leave and we travel across the sea. Well, you're stuck now because you left town. You're traveling across the sea. You can't go back and have that conversation with the king that you wanted to have. But in Microscope, because you are not limited by time and space, you can literally say, nope, I want to jump back for my turn. Let's go back 100 years, and I want to go see that city that you just destroyed. I want to play out a scene when that city was still around. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So you have this ability to – you're never forced to deal with things that other people make if you're not interested. So you get this very – on one hand, everybody has this immense power to make up stuff, to make up whole empires, to destroy stars, do whatever they want. But at the same time, the other players have the choice – to build on the parts that they think are interesting. So you simultaneously have this vast power but vast freedom, and the two, because of the lack of chronological order, blends quite nicely, surprisingly nicely.
How long does a typical session of Microscope take?
You can play 3 hours, 4 hours if you want to. I find that the difference between if you add one more hour, if you play like a two-hour session, you start to get into detail, but you don't really quite have this moment of like, wow, I get it. If you add another hour on top of that, you'll be like, oh, wait, now I'm really getting it. Now we're really seeing the fruits of building one on top of each other. And then if you go to 4 hours, you'll go, oh, I totally see it. We played like histories that were seven sessions. We played like we kept coming back to the table and playing the same history mm-hmm. and just going deeper and deeper into detail and revealing new and new things that we'd not previously foreseen. And that was fascinating. I mean, it was just it became an epic, and we would look at it and we were literally like PhDs on the topic of this history. We could sit there and discuss, you know, the nature of these alien races at great length because we had spent so much time exploring it. Super fun.
So how do you win, Ben? How do you win?
Yeah, how do you win?
I want experience points and treasure.
That's a good question. Yeah, you win by not having a bad time. That's really the key. You want to have fun. But yeah, I figured out a long time ago that in D&D or Mutants and Masterminds or anything, that the only reward that actually mattered was playing. That if you could, so I say to you, say, hey, guess what? We're going to play D&D, and I'm going to let you be 10 levels higher than any other character in the game. I'll give you, tons of experience points, 10 levels. But you only get to play for 5 minutes. And someone else gets to play for 3 hours, but they're going to be first level, which is a better deal. You know what I mean? It's really playing, getting to talk and to participate is what people want in a game.
Yeah, definitely. But that means you don't get +2 Holy Avengers. What the hell?
Exactly. But imagine if I say you get the +2 Holy Avenger, but you can't take it out. You know what I mean? Like, enjoy your Holy Avenger, but you don't get to play till next week. It's kind of a good reward.
Yeah, I had an old DM who really liked to play the traveling in any game. You didn't just cross his continents in a sentence. You had to, all right, 20 days. Every 20 day you're going to role play that. You're going to roll for random encounters, mark off your rations. And to this day, that's why I don't play D&D much.
Well, see, and that's just a mismatch. Some people really like that. Some people really enjoy that. Or you play something like a story game, which is all about cutting to the chase, all about, like for example, in Microscope, you would only cut right to the moments that were interesting. You would say, let's cut straight to the part where it gets, let's cut straight to the critical moment of discussion, not just kind of slog along. In fact, that's one of the big points of the game, is that the players can be extremely selective about what they want to explore. If someone says, and there's 1,000 years of war, we could just summarize that in a sentence. We never have to go into it. But if somebody wants to go into it, they can be like, hey, let's go back. I want to explore that war. I want to dig into that. It's totally up to them. They have that choice.
Got a quote here from Jason Morningstar, who, for those who are not aware, is the designer of Fiasco.
And an awesome guy.
and preternaturally handsome, is what I've heard.
He is a charming man. I say he's a great spokesman for gaming all around the world. He's such a great person for outreach and for telling people what gaming is. He really is.
And this quote is, Ben Robbins' Microscope may be the clearest written game text I've ever read, which is helpful because it is also one of the most innovative games I've come across in a long time. Microscope engagingly challenges assumptions and upends long-held conventions of play while delivering a singular and satisfying evening of gaming.
And I will tell you, I did pay him $5 for that quote, so I got my money's worth. Yeah, most people don't know that, but he will quote for money. Yeah, absolutely.
Really? I'm going to talk to Mr. Morningstar then. Actually, I wanted to have him back on for talking about the Fiasco Companion, but hopefully we can get him on sometime in the near future. But
Rates might have gone up, I should warn you. Yeah.
It's possible, and maybe I can work out a trade. I don't know. well, hey, so Microscope, people are loving it. Lots of positive reviews pretty much everywhere you look. What's coming up next? Is there a follow-up to Microscope? Is there another product percolating in the back of your mind? What you thinking
about? There is. Yeah, one of the rules of design is, like, you never want to wait till you're done to start the next thing because, you always got to have something else going on. So there's another game I've been working on almost a year now, kind of off and on. But I'm not quite ready to talk about it yet. I can tell you the code name. The code name is Kingdom, but I won't go into any more about that. We play tested it a couple times, and I've been very happy with it. But it took 2 years to get Microscope into anything like shape for a release, and I don't think this one will take as long because I don't think it's quite as weird as Microscope. But so funny story, when I was telling Eric, the owner of Gamma Ray Games, which is a game store here in Seattle, which is, we love it. It's like our great game store. We game there all the time. It's a fantastic place. But he was asking the same questions. What's next? Are you a one-hit wonder? Do you have another game coming up? And I wasn't really ready to bring it up yet. He said, well, let me guess. Let me take a guess. His guess was that it was the, I think it's as relevant as Microscope is. And he laughed out loud that he thought that was my criteria for whether or not the game would be any good was, how relevant was it? Did it have any applicability to the human condition? So, but that is kind of my test, that the game has to be – fun is good. I like fun. But I feel that the game has to be something you can do something with, something that teaches is too strong of a word, but something that actually has a some merit other than just being purely entertaining. It's going to make you think, something like that. Make you stretch your brain a little bit.
So, Ben, what are you doing at designing games?
I do computer work, stuff like that. But now, I'll tell you honestly, mostly designing games. And actually, you know what else I do? Playing games. I play a lot. I play a lot of games. And I think to anyone out there who is interested in design or interested in any of these games, play the games. There's reading about it or thinking about it or designing useless if you're not sitting at a table looking at other people, seeing how these things work. Because that honestly, for Microscope, that was fantastically educating. Was seeing how I played with a ton of different people playtesting Microscope, tons of people, probably like 60 games before we released it that I played at the table with lots of different people, and watching brand new people, some who'd never role played before, some who'd played traditional games, some who'd played all types of games, watching how they reacted and how they experienced the game and how they, the ideas they came up with and just how they, the different avenues of thought they went down. That is what will show you whether or not a game is good. And also, even if you don't want to be a designer, just play. I mean, playing the games is the important part. And that's the fun part.
So one reason I like Skype, because there's a lot more playing over Skype the last few years than I have in person.
Yeah, and actually Skype, like online playing like that, I think that's really cool too. It's sometimes a lot of people try to play Microscope on bulletin boards, like forums, and they say it's weird, you know, and I'm like, yeah, of course it's weird. you're typing messages back and forth. Of course it's going to be awkward to try to play scenes. You know, you avoided the warranty by trying to play by mail. It's not sure it's going to work out.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan about playing on boards anyway, just cause I think you lose a lot of the, playing over the phone or over Skype is one thing. You kind of lose a personal element just right there because you don't have nonverbal, which is huge. But,
and you can't have that dynamic interaction. You can't have that moment of like, wait, do you like that? Do I like that? You can't have that kind of jockeying back and forth, which is so critical to understanding what people are thinking. You know, to get real time feedback on what people are thinking about the game.
Yeah, if you have to be in a play by mail game that didn't fizzle out after a week or two, just because doesn't have the same engagement, I don't think. And I mean, people do it for years and it's very successful. I just haven't been a part of that yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So although it seems like, I don't know. I'm a fan of the story game movement just because I think it's moving games in a direction that's more accessible to more people. I mean, because, I don't have to spend 2 hours making a character. I can jump in and we're doing the fun stuff now.
Right.
And, I think that's one reason why board games and card games are more popular, because you get to the cool stuff quicker. There's less there's less front-loading the crunchy bits that scare off the newbies.
Yeah, and it's like, so we run, one of the other things I do is I'm the organizer for Story Game Seattle, which is a weekly public meetup. So pretty much every Thursday night, we meet up, and it's open to the public. So all sorts of people come in, and they just walk in. Some people have never gamed before. Some people have only played, D&D or whatever. They come in, and we say, hey, welcome everybody. Let's all sit down, and we're going to break up into groups, and we're going to play some games. And it is fantastic. People who've never played these kind of games before, some people who are not even sure. Like, we have people come in all the time who've never role-played, have no idea what they're doing. And yet when you present it, people understand people. When you say, this is a story about people, if this story is about, does the woman become reunited with her daughter? Does the soldier decide to disobey orders in order to do the right thing? People don't have to understand gaming because they understand people. They understand drama. They understand story. And so when they're confronted with that in very direct terms, they dig right in. And I've seen people who literally thought 5 minutes ago they couldn't do this. You can see them blossom as they suddenly get what they're doing, and they get really excited and they have a great time.
Yeah, that's why I like story games for that reason. Although I gotta tell you, I like Spirit of the Century and Dresden Files, but I've met several people online and in person who, had trouble running those games. And they're supposed to be more rules light, but
well, they're still their fate. Fate is way rules heavier than like story games that we play. Like Shock is, I think, a tenth of the page count of any Fate book anywhere. And a lot of those games, if you think about it, so here's the big distinction, right? Some games are games of skill where, if I know the rule system well, I'm going to play better. If I know the rules well, I'm going to play well. If I'm playing the hero system and I know the rules well, I am going to win. I'm going to beat you because I know tactically better how to play. In games like Fate is like that too. Fate has a very mechanical benefit. If you know the rules well, you can play it to your advantage. You're going to do better. If you were just a total newbie and you'd never played a game like that before, you would be at a substantial disadvantage. But there's other game designs where the only skill is coming up with good plot ideas. So that mechanically, there's no way to have an advantage by understanding the rule system better. The rules are very simple. You know what I mean? And those games, you'll have people sit down, and there's no danger of them being at a disadvantage from not understanding the rules. And those are, I think, the real winner games for beginners. Like, you play Fiasco, right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly that. There's no mechanical advantage you're going to get from knowing how to play Fiasco better than somebody else. It just isn't that kind of game.
It's a different boy, what's the best way to express it? Your end point's different. You're not trying to collect gear or collect experience points. It's more, you know, it's explicitly focused on having a good time at the table and, you know.
Precisely.
Doing, yeah, yeah.
And you can't even lose. I mean, like a game like Fate, you can do badly and have your character basically be losing. Like, I've taken a lot of injuries, you know, because I screwed up. I didn't do well. Most of the story games, there's no way to die. It's not physically possible unless you agree to be killed. There's no way to really disadvantage your character except in the fiction. You know what I mean? There's not a, oops, you rolled badly, you have less power going forward. Because most games, most of the story games just are not like that. It's a whole different design philosophy.
Yeah, it's and I think that's probably, well, you probably run into it. You said you go to some local conventions and stuff. I'm imagining you probably have a conversation occasionally with a grognard who's like, "What? What is this you're doing?"
Yeah, people will come. And that's happened repeatedly where people will come. They'll come to Story Game Seattle, a game of people go play Northwest, game of people. You know, we had a whole variety of miniature cons up and down the coast this year. Just the house cons, people like throwing a little con on their house. You know, 20 people, 30 people. Small gaming conventions like Fabricated Realities. Fabricated Realities, yo. Got a shout out to the most awesome miniature con ever. And you'll have people come in who are like, I'm a pro gamer. I've played for years. I'm really experienced. I'm going to do great at this. And you say, I say to them, this is very different than playing D&D. So just be prepared. And here's why it's going to be different. And then they can't shake off their habits, and they don't have a good time. And they have often, sometimes, usually people will adjust. I've had a couple people have extremely bad times because it's not what they like. And it's wrong to think everybody has to like the same things. You might, I mean, I've played a zillion years of D&D. Just because you like D&D doesn't mean you should like story games. Just because you like story games doesn't mean you should like D&D. People are allowed to like different things. And it's a mistake to think that because you like one, you will automatically like the other. And that's what gets people. They get tripped up.
Well, I think too much maybe gets put under the big umbrella of gaming when it's, I mean, it's a very different
Absolutely.
Flavor. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it'd be like, I love tactical combat in D&D. I really like it, but it doesn't mean that I would, you know, I mean, they're not related. They're completely unrelated activities. And it'd be like saying to somebody, you know, like, well, you like, can't even think of an example. You like chess, therefore you must like Monopoly. Why are those two even similar?
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm heading, because, I mean, the D&D experience is hell, it's even different from the World of Darkness experience, as opposed to a more free-form story game where, you know, like you say, knowledge of the rule system or, you know, thinking tactically isn't really going to be an advantage to get you where you're trying to go.
No, not at all. In fact, it can be a disadvantage if you're thinking too much that way. And again, you can also like both. Like, I enjoy tactical D&D combat. But whenever, if I'm doing that, if I'm playing that kind of game, I'm not going to say, hey, why don't we have more story game elements? Where's the plot? If that's not what we're doing at the time. You can like both and still have them be separated activities. You know, all of these things are possible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, hey, Ben, I really appreciate your time. Anything else you want to cover before we call it a podcast?
Go play. Just play more. Stop talking. Stop listening to me. Go play.
It's Fahrenheit. Well, we'll get this up Friday. Yeah, do what Ben says. He's a smart man. All right.
Okay.
Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in. Appreciate your time. And we'll talk to you next time on the Banff Podcast.